Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Valerie Martin's novel, Mary Riley, purports to be the diary of Dr. Jekyll's housemaid. Her novel, Property, is also written in a voice from the past, an antebellum slave owner. Her latest is a fictional memoir of a talented and ambitious actor in 1970s New York. The title of her new book is The Confessions of Edward Day. Valerie Martin joins me in the studio along with her longtime and distinguished editor, Nan Talese, whose imprint now at Doubleday is dedicated to the publication of a select list of quality fiction and nonfiction. Throughout the hour, we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Nan, how good to see you again.
Well, it's wonderful for me to see you again and to be here.
And Valerie, congratulations on your new novel.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great.
Jane Smiley has a wonderful review of it. I was so pleased to see that. Nan, tell us how you first came to publish Valerie's works.
I have published Margaret Atwood over 30 years. And one day she had told me that she was going to be a writer in residence in Alabama at this university. And after she returned, she walked into my office with two boxes and she said, I have met an author and you should be her publisher. And it was Valerie Martin.
And when Margaret Atwood says something, everybody listens.
Well, no, I have to say that, I read the manuscript and thought, what a wonderful talent this is. Yes, I do want to publish her. And I still have in an orange box one of them that you never finished.
Well, Valerie Martin, is there a story behind your dedication to Nan?
Oh, yes.
An intrepid night swimmer.
She is an intrepid night swimmer. This story takes off with one of the characters getting caught in a riptide and nearly drowning. Nan has a house on the Jersey Shore, and the house that they go to, the party house at the beginning of the novel, a bunch of young actors gather together for a weekend, a July 4th weekend. That house is Nan's house, and when I was visiting her there, we went out with the dogs one day, and Nan was going to go swimming, and she swims at night, which I'm terrified of drowning.
Wow.
And swimming at night, to me, is just utter madness.
Yeah.
And she doesn't just paddle around in the shallows. She swims out past the breakers until you can't see her, and the dogs are barking. They're terrified. So that was a moment when I began to think about a lot of things, one of them my own terror of drowning. And the other thing was a story that Nan told me about a young editor who came out to visit and got caught in one of these riptides. And Nan and her daughter swam out and saved him. And because they were shouting help and being frightened, her impulse, being who she is, was to call.
As
she's swimming to the rescue, she calls out, "Be calm, don't shout."
Yes, my daughter was so, when we finally got her bow around the rocks and people were waiting on the next beach to see whether it would make it in, and Pamela yelled, "Help, help." And I said, "Shh, don't shout, it's bad manners."
Don't shout while drowning.
But you know what strikes me at the heart is that I got caught in a riptide with my 7-year-old son.
Oh, gosh.
Down at Ocean City, Maryland. And I realized I had taken him out on a raft. And I realized all of a sudden I couldn't touch the ground. And so I said to him as calmly as I could, "David, we're going to have to yell for help." My husband was on shore. He's a powerful swimmer, but he was on shore with a dislocated shoulder in a sling. We began hollering. The lifeguards came, and we were saved. So that story really got to the heart of me.
You know, it's amazing how many people have nearly drowned on the Jersey Shore and in those Maryland waters.
Exactly.
People should just stay out of those waters.
Well, they're gorgeous waters, but you have to be very, very careful. Valerie, what made you want to write about acting in the 70s?
Well, a couple of years ago, I guess more than about 3 years ago, I was commissioned to write, to make a play out of my novel Property. And in the course of that, I went with a producer and we had various staged readings and I got to see actors audition. And I remember one cold winter day watching these young women come in to audition for a part in a musical. And they would come and take all their heavy clothes off and they'd have on little sort of showgirl outfits. They'd go into the audition room, they'd belt out a Broadway tune and then they'd be dismissed. They'd put all their... It was horrible to watch. I went outside the room, and one of them was nursing a baby, waiting to audition. And I thought, you know, this is worse than publishing. So I began to think I was interested in the actor's life. It was a difficult life. And the more I began to look into it and talk to actors and read about it, the more I felt it was in some ways like what I do, creating characters. And also that it's really an art. I don't think I understood before how much... study and how much of an artistic endeavor is involved and just putting on a little play in a small town.
But the idea of focusing on that particular decade, what was it in that decade that so drew you?
Well, a number of things. I could remember that decade, so that was very helpful. I didn't have to do too much research.
Right.
I had come to the city a lot during that time, and so I knew what it looked like. But it was an interesting time for actors because it was when the off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway theaters began to open. There didn't used to be those venues. It was a much smaller, there were a much smaller amount of theaters for actors to work in. But the problem was that these off-Broadway venues were not union, and so actors who really wanted to work and wanted to do new plays often got paid nothing or a very small amount to be in these plays. So they were really put in a very difficult position. If you wanted to work, you wanted to work in these theaters, but you wouldn't get paid. It was very difficult to work, to get in Broadway shows. Public theater started up right around that time and was a very exciting, interesting place. The actors who were working in New York at that time, many of them left, went to Hollywood. If you just think of a lot of film actors that you know and admire now, like Meryl Streep and William Hurt, and it's just scores of them. They were all working in these small theaters and taking acting classes from the great teachers. Stella Adler was still teaching, Meissner, Uta Hagen. These teachers had been people who had been working with the Stanislavski method from the beginning. So it was a very exciting and difficult time for actors.
The book jacket, the cover, is a silhouette of a very, very handsome man. One can see that. But there are shadows. There's a newspaper slice. There is a slightly open mouth. He really is fascinating. But he is a he, Valerie, and you are writing... you are in his mind.
Yes, it's a first-person narrative.
How difficult was that for you?
To write like a man?
Mm-hmm.
Or to think like a man,
To think as a man.
I have a sort of standard response for that. It's not really that difficult. You just imagine yourself to be a little more entitled, a little easier to dupe, a little more unconscious of the consequences of your actions. You're off.
What did you think of that, Nan?
Well, when I finished reading the manuscript, I called Valerie and I said, you can just do anything. Anything you set your mind to. And I often have a very difficult time reading a manuscript by a woman and the first person singular is a man's voice. I had absolutely no trouble at all.
Why do you have such a hard time?
Well, because it doesn't feel real. Mm. And, you know, particularly if it's a well-known writer. And, you think, I mean, men, if they write about women and women's perspective, usually do it in the third person. But Valerie was doing it in the first person. Right. And I think your mind just automatically sees a male name. And so when it begins with I, you think it's a man. But, you know, as I said, Valerie is so magical in her voice, in her writing, that my first response, I don't know if you remember, I said, there's just nothing you cannot do.
Yeah, because she believed the male
yeah,
voice.
Yeah, right from the start.
You believe the male voice. How much went into the collaboration between the two of you from your first reading to final publication?
You want to take that?
You take it.
Nan made an offer for the book based on about 40, 50 pages, and she was interested in it and excited by those opening scenes. And we usually we've worked that way on several books. And then I, you know, go away and then finish the book. And when I turned it in, I got that wonderful response. Uh-huh. It's always when I turn it in, I don't always get that wonderful response.
Valerie Martin, her new novel is titled The Confessions of Edward Day. She's here in the studio with publisher and editor Nan Talese of Doubleday. Stay with us. Welcome back to Esteemed Writers, Authors are with me. Valerie Martin, her newest is titled The Confessions of Edward Day, and Nan Talese, she's Senior Vice President of Doubleday and the publisher and editorial director of Nan A. Talese Doubleday. That's a trade book publishing imprint. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Valerie, we've been talking so much about this swimming, drowning. Would you read for us from
that place? I will read a bit
place?
Of a drowning scene.
Good.
This is our narrator, Edward Day, has fallen off the pier on the Jersey Shore.
Is he drunk?
He's not drunk. He's been seducing a young lady and has had quite a lively evening. He might have had some drinks at some point. But he was just going for a little relaxing walk after returning her to the house, the party house where he's staying with his friends. And he's leaning on the edge of the pier, and the rail gives way, and he just falls right in. And what he doesn't know at first is that he's fallen right in through a riptide, because those are often around piers. He's not a terribly great swimmer, and he doesn't know anything about a riptide. All he knows is that the more he tries to swim towards shore, the farther he gets. What I learned from Nan Talese was that if you fall in a riptide, and this is cautionary news for everyone, swim across it,
exactly,
parallel to the shore, Do not fight the water.
I learned that too late.
In many, well, you live to tell
the
tale.
But you stay on top of the water. The thing is, if you put your leg or your arm down into it, the tide pulls you. But if you stay on top of the water, it'll eventually bring you in.
Well, that's what we know now. But Edward didn't know that. He's been drowning now for about three pages. And we're going to enter this section with him talking about the sensations that he has while drowning. And he's about to meet the other main character, his sort of doppelganger, Guy Margate. My body was giving out on me, but my only choice was to forge on. I'd lost communication with my legs. My chest was sinking with every stroke. I was swallowing more water than air. I'm not going to make it, I thought. I'm drowning. Help! I heard myself cry as my head slipped under the water. I thrashed back up, cried out again. Help! A fierce cramp in my right calf muscle sent a shockwave to my brain. I rolled onto my back, clutching my leg with one hand, treading with the free arm and good leg, but of course I sank again. Just kick through the pain, I thought, and I got back up, took a deep breath of air, and switched to frog-like pumping of arms, legs, not because I thought it might help, but because that was what my body did. I had run out of thoughts. Only terror and sadness inhabited me, only emotions. That's what we come down to, after all. I struggled on, but I kept going under, each time a little longer, every breath of air more shallow than the last. It was silent below. Above, the only sound was my gasping and my heart pounding in my ears. Help! I heard myself cry as I went down again. Help! I battled my way back into the air. Be calm, a voice commanded. Was it my own? No, it came to me from out of the air. In the next moment, something big, something powerful, slammed into my legs and grasped my waist. I kicked to free myself, but it held me fast, swarming up my body, pulling me down. A man's head surfaced close to mine. His arm slipped under my own, holding me close. Don't fight me, he said. I clutched his neck. Save me, I pleaded, clinging to him. Don't push me down, you idiot, he said. You'll drown us both. He grasped my hands and pulled them apart, pushing free of me. No, I cried. Don't leave me. He caught hold of my shoulder and pulled it, turning me away from him. Lie on your back, he said. Make yourself as flat as you can. I can't, I said, but I tried, and as my legs came up, he brought his arm across my chest and pulled me in so that my head rested against his sternum. That's it, he said. I'll keep your head up. Kick if you can. I can, I said, and I tried, but my legs were numb. We were moving, however. Somehow he was ferrying me through the water, not against the current, but across it, so that we were still being carried away from the shore. A peculiar lassitude had taken over my senses, but I made a feeble protest. Wrong way, I panted. Please shut up, he said. I couldn't catch my breath. It was as if my lungs were frozen. Where was I? Of course, I concluded. This was a dream from which I would straightway awaken. Then I felt something swelling beneath me, lifting me so gently, and my rescuer as well, carrying us up, up, and I saw the stars, a sliver of the moon, and the twinkling of lights from the land toward which we were being forcefully conveyed on the long plume of a wave that, in the next moment, collapsed beneath us, leaving us foundering before the onslaught of the next one. I clung to my companion and held my breath. When I opened my eyes again, I was flat on my back on the sand, and a man was kneeling over me, his eyes closed, his lips approaching mine like a lover. I rolled onto my side and coughed up a quality of phlegm. He got to his feet, straddling me without comment. My God, I said, what happened? You passed out, he said. Then I remembered the rail slipping away, my plunge into the waves, the current carrying me against my will. I turned onto my back and gazed up at him. I was drowning, I said. You saved my life. In the dim moonlight, I could just make out his face. His dripping hair was dark and long, like mine. His eyes were deep-set, heavy-lidded. His jaw was strong. He was tall, like me, and handsome, like me. He considered me, still wheezing pitiably at his feet, while the waves pounded in, and the moon, obscured by a passing cloud, cast us into darkness. I was conscious of how cold and wet the sand was, and how it gave beneath me, sucking at me, ready to cover me over like the rest of the debris, disgorged and deposited on the shore by the ceaseless scouring of the tides. I was sick, weak, and grateful to be alive. My rescuer stepped away from me, addressing the air. That was quite a performance, Ed, he said. A deeper chill invaded my spine. Had I heard him correctly? How do you know my name? I asked. Why shouldn't I? I pried myself out of the sand. Just sitting required an exertion of energy that alarmed me. Where was my strength? Because I don't know you, I said. He smiled at this, a mocking smile that took offense. You know me, Ed, he said. I'm Guy Margate. The name meant nothing to me, but there was something familiar about him. I must have met him at some party or in a bar. Sorry, I lied. I didn't recognize you. I'm not myself. Are you ever? What? I came out to have a smoke on the pier, he said, and I heard you screaming. I staggered to my feet. You saved my life, I said again. How can I repay you? Oh, he said, we'll think of a way.
Valerie Martin, reading from her new book. It's titled The Confessions of Edward Day. You take my breath away.
Yeah.
Truly, because that's such a powerful scene. And yet you pick up these likenesses that are going to show up again and again throughout the book, the similarities he sees in Guy Margate's
yes.
face and stature. This whole idea that perhaps he's looking at himself.
Yes, he's definitely found his double and found his. It's a very gothic sort of Faustian scene. It's, you know, is he about to sell his soul? And Guy's notion that there will be a way to repay this debt is sort of scary as he delivers it, and it becomes, in fact, really quite a terrible thing in Ed's life that he can never. His biggest problem is that he can never really feel the debt because he doesn't like the person who rescued him.
Nantelis, the power of the imagination when it comes to writing a book. You must see manuscript after manuscript, and you have to make that judgment as to, you know, it's sort of like saving a life. What is worthy? What is worthy to be saved and what is not?
You know, I think it all comes down to, I mean, of all the arts, books are the most personal. You have the writer's voice and you have the reader. I mean, we listen to music together, we go to museums together, every other art is shared in a group. But books, it's just one-to-one. And I respond to what the writer has written. And I mean, I think there are three things that are common to all of the authors that I published. One is their use of language. You've just heard very carefully with Valerie reading. And the other is storytelling.
Mm.
They're all, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, they're storytellers. And the third is passion about their subject. And that author's passion is conveyed to a reader, and so you want to stay with it. And there's a wonderful story that was told to me. I think it was a teacher that asked some fairly young children what did they do with their free time, and three of them said they watched television, and one said she read books. And the teacher said, why do you like books over television? And the student replied, because I like the pictures better.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about book is the reader is a participant in creating the images in his or her mind. And what I do is I respond to what I read, and then I hope that everyone else will too.
Exactly.
I like that notion of the pictures, because I think what happens a lot of times when you go to a film made from a book is that you feel annoyed because you didn't picture the characters as looking like that, or you feel that the vision of the book is not the same as yours. Or if you like the film, it's because it was in some way, it resembled the picturing that you'd done.
Mary Riley, about Dr. Jekyll's mm-hmm. secretary. That was made into a movie.
It was very strange to watch, yes.
Why?
just to see the dialogue that I wrote being delivered by famous actors is very strange.
But did you like what they did with it?
I wasn't crazy about it. I liked some things about it. I liked the atmosphere of it. I liked the darkness of it. I know that when they made the film, there were a lot of problems with the script, and ultimately I think they had so much difficulty making it that it wasn't as good as it could have been.
Well, and of course there is a darkness here as well as light. I mean, there are three primary characters whose lives become extraordinarily entangled, both, as we said earlier, on stage and off stage. I wonder about the reality of creating that kind of connection, Valerie.
Well, the wonderful thing about actors is that they feel most alive when they're on stage.
Ah.
And when they're not on stage, they're usually looking for work. they're trying to get on stage. So they're very obsessed and very motivated people. And as a writer, it's very interesting to write about people who have obsessions. I think Raymond Carver said that, you know, writers have obsessions, and so they understand people who have obsessions.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. The question becomes, what does Edward Day need to confess?
Yeah, that is a good question. And why does Edward Day feel he needs to confess?
Why?
I don't think he knows, and I don't think as he writes this confession, he's aware of the story he's telling about himself. I think that's generally the case when we try to explain something that we've done that we may not feel entirely good about. That we're speaking in self-defense, even though our sense is that we're simply trying to explain what happened. And that's Edward's condition in this story. I don't think he could ever acknowledge that he felt guilty about what ultimately happens to both Guy and his beloved actress, Madeline.
Talk about Madeline, who she is.
Well, Madeline is a young actress who's at the beach party and Guy is seduced by her. They're together. They're apart. He admires her as an actress. He originally apprehends her as a very strong person. Gradually comes to understand that she's rather fragile. He doesn't want to know that. He doesn't want to be responsible for her, yet he's very drawn to her. You never see her except through his eyes.
Mm.
And so it's very difficult to tell what Madeline is really like. But if you follow what happens to her, you can see that there's a lot of things that have happened that Edward doesn't want to take responsibility for, though he knows it was his fault.
There's a passage here where Edward says, inside a character, I knew exactly who I was. The environment was controlled. No one was going to do anything unexpected. It seemed a way of playing it safe. Of course, real acting is the farthest thing from safe a person can get, but I didn't know that then. I found myself wondering about both of you there and whether for you, Nan Talese, reading is the safest place for you.
That's a very interesting question. It's much more real to me than life itself. My husband teases me that nothing seems real unless I've read it on a page. And I know when I was growing up, I grew up in a very sort of social atmosphere, but I always carried a book because I felt that what I was reading was more real than what I was living. And I think I really do. I mean, there's so much that one learns from a book. I mean, one of the things that we haven't talked about is Valerie's extraordinary observations on the way people behave and her marvelous dry sense of humor. And, you know, you pick up a book and you meet these characters and you have these adventures and you experience the wisdom of the author's knowledge. And It's truly wonderful.
It takes you to another place.
Yes.
And for you, inside the world of writing must be a very safe and scary place.
It's safer than scary now. I think when I was younger, it was a little scarier. But now I really enjoy when I get into the world of a character. It is, to me, more interesting than my life, which is very dull. Business of, you know, I'm very happy, very pleasant, everything's comfortable, and I don't have anything I have to do except work on my book. And the older I get, the more time I spend in the world of the book, very happy to be there, and sometimes frightened by what's going on, but not for myself, for my characters.
Valerie Martin, her new book is titled The Confessions of Edward Day. Nan Talese of Doubleday has her own imprint within Doubleday. She's published Pat Conroy, Margaret Atwood, Ian McEwan, and many others.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the rise and fall and rise again of the Taliban. We talk with reporter Charles Sennett, who's been covering the Taliban since 1995 and recently returned to Afghanistan, where he met with Taliban leaders. Sennett is executive editor of the Global Post online international news service. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. Writer Valerie Martin is with me. We're talking about her latest novel. It's titled The Confessions of Edward Day. With me also her distinguished editor, Nan Talese. Do join us, 800-433-8850. First to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I was just actually asking, writing is such an introspective activity. I was just curious what kind of key questions or life questions, human questions, however you want to term it, does your novel really bring up?
Oh, I think the big question is a question about what identity is and how we make our personalities out of our responses to the world. Actors are interesting to me because they understand that identity is divided and that sometimes we have one feeling with our heart and another with our head. I read an actor who said when he's acting, he tells one story to his heart and one to his head, and that when you're watching an actor, you see that division, and we empathize with them because we feel that division. So it is, I think the whole question of wanting to believe that we are all simple And that, you know, if you talk about yourself, my identity is Valerie Martin. I'm interested in the question of whether maybe that's not so simple. Maybe there are two or three or four. I'm not talking about split personalities. I'm just talking about reactions to the outside world and roles that we play, such as myself as a mother, myself as a daughter, two different people.
Is it a search for each of us that's different for women than it is for men?
I don't think that the process is different. I think women have a different experience of the world for a number of reasons. They're physically different. They can have children. And, you know, historically they've been pushed to the back burner whenever possible, or stuffed in burkas, or you know, put away. They have a different experience of the world, but I think the process of coming to your identity is similar. You are forced into society, and then sometimes you're not. I feel that when I'm alone, I have an identity that I recognize as my own. Sometimes when I'm not, when I'm in public, when I'm in social functions, and I'm listening to myself, I'm thinking, who is that? And I think
it's very interesting.
I think many people have that, male or female, and you know, who you are is how you respond to that sensation of alienation from others.
Here's a call from Riverdale, Maryland. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. Ms. Talese, I'm wondering if you could talk about the amount of work that editors do with authors in actually editing the text, and talk about now versus in the past. We heard recently about Gordon Lish decimating the words of Raymond Carver, which is a little extreme, but a lot of the authors I read now I think could do with a slightly heavier hand as far as cutting goes.
Well, I think there's always been complaints that books are not edited enough, and it depends on which book. And Gordon Lish was also a writer and a teacher, and he kept a very firm control. But, in fact, the book belongs to the author. And as an editor, my main job is to question what I don't understand. And the author hears the question and decides whether it's legitimate or not. And I feel that it's terribly important. I learned this very, very young when I was doing line editing on the brilliant writer Robert Penn Warren. And I was very nervous because he was just such an esteemed writer. And I remember asking him at about page 50, who is that character? Will you identify? And he said, he enters on the second chapter. And, of course, I thought I just flunked the exam and I was embarrassed. And he saw my embarrassment and he said, no. If you don't remember him, I either have to reintroduce him here or I have to make his introduction more memorable. And, you know, I was 20-something, but it taught me that I'm just a reader. I represent the average reader, and I asked the question.
And your instinct was right on target.
And it was, and he was wonderful. And sometimes, I remember Margaret Atwood, after going through a number of drafts of a novel, and at the end, I said to her, I don't quite understand. I don't think the reader is going to know if that scene took place in the character's mind or whether it was real. And she thought for a minute and she said, I don't care.
And that's all she needed
and,
to say.
You know, her name's on the book. So.
That's exactly right. Thanks for calling, Diane. I hope that answers it. Here's an email from Jesse, who says the voice of Edward Day is indeed powerful and believable. Too often assumptions are made regarding a male lack of intuition, sensitivity, or empathy, compassion. Men have the same capacity for these things as women, just as women have the capacity for entitlement or the ability to ignore the consequences. Valerie.
I think that's probably true. And it really is always dangerous to generalize about the sexes. And in fact, one reason I feel comfortable going ahead and writing from the point of view of a man is that there's so many different kinds of people, male and female, that I feel certain there's a man out there somewhere who's a lot like me or a lot like Edward Day. And, you know, he will be recognizable insofar as he's an individual.
to St. Louis. Good morning, Dan. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to piggyback on the comments, I guess, that was emailed in. I also wanted to respond to your depiction of how men think. And I mean, I love the show, and I'm sure you're a really good writer. It sounds like you're a feminist and everything, which I agree with totally. But as a man who grew up in a family full of men haters, and that's pretty abusive, I wanted to let you know and to educate you that what you said is really hurtful, and it hurt and disturbed me. And you may not realize it, but what you said really comes close to hate speech, and you probably didn't mean it, but I just wanted to make you aware that that kind of speech, if you would substitute any racial or ethnic minority or even women for men in what you said, you would see that your comment was really hurtful. And I think as a true feminist, which is a movement that stems from a reaction against oppression, there really isn't room for advancing negative stereotypes against anyone. And when somebody does that, even if it's, innocently or even in the spirit of fun, you really, tend to incite or instigate a feeling of, people are hurt, men are hurt by it. And I think that's part of the backlash against what people see as feminism, which I don't think is really true feminism. I mean, I'm a real proponent of true feminism, which I don't think advocates hatred against, should not advocate hatred against anyone, including men.
Dan, I appreciate your call. Valerie.
Well, I think that's a really good point, and can't be denied. I was speaking sort of in a joking spirit. You are certainly and obviously the exception. I can hear that you do not feel particularly entitled, and are that you probably consider the consequences of your actions. Otherwise, you wouldn't make such a phone call. So I appreciate it. Stand corrected, and you're absolutely right. We really don't need this sort of pushing away. But that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write from the male point of view. I make that joke because people find it amusing, I suppose. But when I write from the male point of view, I am not thinking of my character as someone really other than myself. I mean, I'm trying as much as I can to create a man, and I did create a man, that I care for a lot. I think if you read Edward Day, you will find that he's quite a complex character.
He sure is.
And he's an artist, and art is very important to him. And, male or female, we have a great deal in common.
Dan, I'm glad you called. Here's an email from John who says, while this is a question that does not pertain to the author's book, please ask what their opinions are regarding the move to e-books, that is, how authors would make money, what happens to the publishing industry. Nan Talese.
Well, I mean, I think e-books really are a wonderful invention, and I think more people will become familiar with more books and more authors' voices through e-books. In the last decade, and perhaps earlier than that, publishing has expanded to become much fatter than it needs to be. And I think that the future of books through the Kindle, through ebooks, is going to be that the author is going to speak more directly to the reader, and that we as publishers are certainly going to play a very important role, but it doesn't have to be as overweening as it has been in the last decade or so.
All right, to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Ron.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Surely.
Whenever I have this opportunity, I ask this question. Personally, I've experienced and I've heard other writers tell me that once you begin a story and get it set up, it tends to write itself. I know Mark Twain had said with Huck Finn, there's only one right way to start a story. After that, it begins on its own. I wanted to ask your editor and writer, if they feel the same thing, if they start to go down a certain path once the groundwork's laid for a story.
Valerie.
I think that there really is a right starting place, and I've often had an idea for a story and started it and then had to throw the pages away because I had not begun at the right moment but in time or in the character's life. So there's a lot of thinking before starting, And I completely agree that if you start in the right place, if you get the right first sentence, then you'll be able to move forward with ease. And if you don't, that you have this sort of difficulty in getting started. So for me, the first 50 pages are the most important pages. By the time I get to 50 pages, I know if I'm going to be able to go on with the story or if I'll just have to fold it up, which sometimes happens.
Nan, is that true for
Nanny? It's, you know, each writer is different, but I do remember what John O'Hara said in talking about writing, and he said the first 100 pages you write are just getting you to know your characters, and then you begin the book.
So you begin, if you've begun in the right place, you will move and move and move, but then once you hit that right place, does the book begin to write itself?
Well, I wish they would write themselves.
Yeah, I bet you do.
It would save me a lot of time and struggle. They don't exactly write themselves, but I think that the question about starting is an important one, especially for young writers, to learn to be willing to wait until you have figured out enough about the story to proceed in a straightforward way.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Murray, Kentucky. Hi there, Drew. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I am interested generally in autobiographical fiction. I read some once that a critic had said that all autobiography is a form of confession, and the impulse is to rejoin or to regain community. I was interested if Ms. Martin would comment on the relationship she sees between autobiography, confession, and community.
Yeah, I really like that notion that that autobiography is confession. Whenever you read autobiographies, you can see right through the writer to the thing that he's really ashamed of or the thing that he feels really good about. It's one of the mysteries of personality. That's the whole, if we could see ourselves as others see us, what a gift would be to give us, as Robbie Burns said. And I do also like the idea of confession as a kind of effort to enter a community. I think apology is like that too, which is why it can be so important if you feel that you've wronged someone to apologize, because it allows you to re-enter the whole community and the friendship with someone who you may have offended. It's why politicians are always apologizing. They're trying to get back into the community that may reject them. I mean, you may think even, well, the apology is insincere, but the act of making an apology or of going to confession is in itself a gesture toward community. I totally agree.
Nan Talese, I cannot let you go without asking you about the memoir of your 50-year marriage that your husband, Gay Talese, is working on. Tell me about that.
Well, both his agent and his editor were sort of stunned when he said that was the next book he was going to do, and they said to me, "Nan, what do you think of it?" And I said, "I don't know if Gay knows anything about marriage, and I'll be very interested in reading it and see how he's perceived this 50 years together."
What do you mean you think he knows nothing about marriage?
Well, Gay is a writer, and writers by nature are rather narcissistic. And he immediately makes the leap out of himself when he's very interested in another person. But I'm not sure how he perceives our 50 years together, because I've been paying attention to him and, of course, to our daughters. But I have no idea whether he's been how he's received the life that we've lived. And every once in a while, he'll say to me, as he's going through his notes or something, he works in what I call the bunker. It's a huge area underneath the house. And he'll come up from the bunker and he'll say to me, "Do you know, we've lived a very interesting life." But I don't know what it will be, and I refuse to participate in the whole thing, and I'm going to read it just like a reader reads it.
There is some suggestion of infidelity.
Oh, that all comes from my neighbor's wife. And it was very interesting when he was exploring the sexual mores and how we had changed in the 70s with the sexual revolution. And he lived in these nudist camps out in California. But it's the critics who imagined more than actually the book tells.
We'll look forward to reading that book. Nan Talese, she is Senior Vice President of Doubleday, Publisher and Editorial Director of Nan A. Talese Doubleday. That's a trade book publishing imprint. Valerie Martin is the author of a brand new, wonderful novel. It's titled The Confessions of Edward Day. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.